Hello, it's Cliff Thorburn here, and if you'd like to help save lives at sea, call the LBC Marine Call Appeal right now on 0898-500-350. The longer you listen, the more money we raise for this worthwhile cause.
Calls cost 38 pence per minute peak time and 25 pence per minute off-peak. And for every minute you listen, 20 pence is donated to the RNLI. Please call 0898-500-350 now. Update on LBC Radio is the nightly program that brings you the day's news and talks to the people making the headlines. But from the new year, there'll be more, with new regular features, including the week's TV on Mondays, films in the theatre on Tuesdays, fruit and veg on Thursdays, and best buys in wine on Fridays. Plus each night, all the sport, financial news and travel. Make it a date, weekday evenings at 5, with me, Richard Dallin. Update on LBC Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this Christmas edition of the LBC Celebrity Interview at the Barbican. We've been doing them now for 3 years, and among the people I've interviewed have been many people from the stage. But I don't think before I've interviewed anybody who appeared at one stage in public, or rather to the public, on television early in her career in black leather, and who indeed is appearing at this very moment to the theatre audience here in London in very little. In between these two appearances, she has carved a reputation for herself as a very versatile and distinguished British actress. Ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to welcome Diana Rigg. I suppose this sort of thing to you is old hat. I suppose in your career you been dragged from pillar to post, particularly in America. Do you learn to hate people like me?
No, you serve a very good function. You may not realize this. Largely for promotion purposes. Mm. And sometimes it's more enjoyable than others. Certainly in America, it's like being thrown into the lion's den. It's extremely difficult. And in England, thanks to people like you, it's much more sympathetic.
Oh, how kind you are. It means I've got to be kind to you, which I would be anyway. Did you do the Johnny Carson show?
I did. I did it twice.
Did you enjoy it?
I absolutely hated it.
What
I couldn't understand why I did it a second time. He's got an extraordinary tactic. When you walk on stage, you suddenly realize you're at a huge disadvantage because the audience is sitting where you are, in front of me. Johnny Carson is facing them. Your chair is at an angle, so you're angled away from the audience.
Oh.
And Johnny Carson has, in fact, his own camera to which he will react, which is just behind you. So that the odds are very much stacked against you. Plus the fact that he has a sort of sidekick who throws jokes and lines to him if there's a teeniest pause in the conversation.
Mm.
So that you, getting a word in edgeways is extremely... And you really have to have your wits about you.
Yeah, I can't remember whether he is early in the morning or late at night.
He's late at night.
Is he? But
yes.
They do breakfast time ones as well, don't they?
Oh, those are dreadful. Those are absolutely dreadful. Well, you can imagine, as an actress, your life, your rhythms aren't geared to getting up first thing in the morning. And they get you there at 6:30 in the morning, whereupon they start putting rollers in your hair and mascara on your half-closed lids. And it's an outrage.
Mm.
And then you're on for literally 3 minutes.
Mm.
And then you stumble out at 8:45, and the rest of the day is yours, but you don't have the energy to do anything with it.
Mind you, we're getting pretty much like that here, aren't we?
Yes.
Early morning
interviews,
yes.
Yes.
Not a good thing, you think.
No, I think you've got to be an early morning person to do one of those.
Are there certain areas you don't like talking about, that you say to these people when they ask you questions, look, please don't ask me about this?
Well, there are certain questions which keep cropping up. I don't mind talking about the Avengers. I'll talk about the Avengers any other day. Deeply grateful to the Avengers. Loved it.
Yeah.
They always bring certain interviews, they always bring sex in. I can't quite understand why. I mean, here I am, an actress, and I've done sort of all sorts of things that we can talk about. And why sex?
Mm, it's extraordinary.
It is amazing.
Mm. You won't mind me saying then that you were born in Doncaster?
No, I'd love it.
Good. That's a good start. Yet, you spent the early part of your life in India.
Yes.
Now, why?
Well, my father was an engineer, and he answered an advertisement in the Times because jobs were in very short supply where he was in Doncaster. And he went out as a he just attained his apprenticeship. Right. And he went out as a sort of general dog's body and worked his way up through the Indian Civil Service.
Right.
And he was, his early years were so interesting because there were no women where he went. They were building railways, and they were sort of little bungalow stations along the railways. And it was all men, all technicians. And every 5 years, they'd send them home to find a wife. And you had 6 months in which to find a wife.
Incredible.
And if you didn't, then you had to sail back to India and face another 5 years.
Extraordinary existence.
It was very, very. And of course, you can imagine those 6 months were hive of activity when they hit India.
It obviously worked, the 5 years.
Well, they tended to go back, obviously, to their hometown and to the people that they'd known. My father went back to Doncaster, and he met my mother through the golf club. And she went out to India, little knowing what she was going to face out there. And I remember my grandmother gave her the money for the fare home, and she sewed it into her corset, just in case she hated every minute of what she found when she got out there. And it was extraordinary, of course. I mean, there were hygiene was fundamental. There were no doctors, the heat, the disease. And somehow she brought two children up.
How much do you remember of it?
I think not very much. I think my memory is largely coloured by the photographs that we have in the albums at home. But smells and sounds bring a lot of it back. And I love curries as a result.
But you went to boarding school over here.
Yes, my parents decided, I don't know quite how wisely, that the system of schooling out there was very haphazard. One went to a convent. I seem to remember they taught me how to tie laces and nothing much else. My mother taught me how to read. And so we got sent home to school when I was seven. And my mother put me in a school and then sailed back to India. And I'd never seen so many white children before in my life. I walked into this dining room of the school the first day. First of all, I didn't know what boarding school meant. And I suddenly saw a sea of children, white children, and the noise was absolutely incredible. And I was quite alone. I had no friends, no idea of what the life ahead of me meant. And it was a very savage introduction to the English school system.
Was it a very proper young ladies' boarding school?
Yes, it was a preparatory school. It was on very Spartan lines. We slept in the middle of winter, with two blankets on our bed. We weren't allowed any more. The windows were always open. I remember waking up in the morning, I had a chap up my ear. And I woke up in the morning with my ear stuck to the pillow every morning. And then matron would pull us out of bed and shove a spoonful of malt and a spoonful of cod liver oil in our mouths, one after the other. And off we went.
Extraordinary.
Yes.
Yeah. How long were you there?
I was there for 2 years, and then my parents came back, and I was reintroduced to family life.
So this wasn't the school at which your elocution teacher gave you a taste of
theatre? No, I went to that school when I was 11, and that was a Moravian school in Yorkshire. Not very many people know about the Moravians. They're Czechoslovakian sect, and they trekked out of Czechoslovakia because they were suffering religious oppression at that time. They're sort of Quaker. And in 1758, they trekked over to England, and they founded certain settlements. And weaving was one of their specialities. And so they started settlements in the valleys of Yorkshire where the waters were necessary to their trade. And they also started schools. And they were very proper. I think there is I haven't been to it, but I believe there's a Moravian churchyard in London. And at one time, they used to bury the men on one side of the churchyard and the women on the other.
Extraordinary. So how did you get on there? Was it enjoyable? I mean, do you look back on your school days there with pleasure?
Yes, I do. I do. It was part desert, part pasture. The world of literature was opened up to me. The world of mathematics remained irrevocably closed. My daughter now treats me with sort of mild contempt because I simply can't do her maths homework.
You're not alone in this, I'm sure.
And I'm very grateful in that respect that a great joy entered my life at a very early stage.
You're a great one for keeping in touch, aren't you?
Some
of those schoolgirls you still...
Well, it was very sweet, yes. Into my dressing room, in fact, last week, tumbled two of them from the school. And they were both, I think it was their 25th wedding anniversaries, and they'd got 21-year-old children. And we looked at each other and we thought, this is so extraordinary. That we still know each other, that our lives have gone such different ways. And yet we have this wonderful common bond of memory.
It's terrific.
Yes.
You were very close to your father, Diana, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Was he in agreement with you going off to RADA?
He was wise enough to realize that it was the one thing that I wanted, and that not to let me go might possibly have blighted my life. So he let me go. He had grave doubts about it, of course, and London was a long way away. Mm. We didn't have much money, and I think they had to scrape, in fact I know they did, to send me there. And of course it's such a hazardous profession that it was like throwing me into Sin City on the one hand, and without any tools, I was entirely unprepared. Mm. I had nothing.
Well, Pete, you weren't alone in that either, were you? I mean, people who go to RADA do have this lack of any
Oh, absolutely, at all, but yeah. I'm now talking about... Oh, let's work it out. I'm 49, so I went when I was 17, many, many years ago. And I think at 17, one is... In those days, one was much more naive than now. Yeah. Television had only been around for a certain number of years, and one had no idea what a big city meant, let alone what acting meant. I'd only been to the Grand Theatre in Leeds as often as I could afford it, and that's what theatre meant to me, and my poetry books and the plays that I'd been able to read. But the theatre, real theatre, came as a shock.
Did it?
Yes.
Do you remember, I always ask people this, do you remember who was with you in the class of 57?
Oh, yes. We had Sean Phillips, Susanna York. Albert Finney was in the class ahead of me. He was the golden boy, and we all knew that he was going on to great and grand things. It was very interesting, the people who... Sean, for example, won the gold medal and went on, you know, to succeed wonderfully. I scraped through. I was always a late developer.
Yeah. Yes. You didn't automatically get work then when you came away.
No.
You did actually enter the world of, how shall I put it, shorthand typing and things like that.
Yes, I did. I did some modelling. I worked in a blood bank. I worked as a waitress. I at that age, it doesn't matter.
No, quite. So, was the RSC your first serious acting experience?
No, my first serious acting experience was at Chesterfield, where I went as an ASM. And in those days, you went as ASM and small parts as played, which meant that when you weren't rehearsing, you were chasing around the town, begging props from the local shopkeepers, who were very bored by seeing ASMs calling in every week. And also, when you weren't chasing props, we had one sofa, which I had to cover every week with a different piece of material and copy decks and tacks. Now, give me a sofa now, and I could still do it.
Yes, I bet you could. Yeah. So how long between Chesterfield and the RSC was there?
I worked in Chesterfield for a year, and by that time I had done an audition for the RSC, and they'd said, go away and get some experience and come back, which was a pretty catch-22 situation.
It was, really, yeah.
But anyway, I was lucky enough to get into Chesterfield, and then I went to the RSC play as cast, which is very sweet and funny because play is hardly the word. I mean, walk on as cast. <Yeah. laughs>
But it must have been marvellous, I mean, to actually get into the RSC,
yes,
particularly at that time.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it was an exciting time. It is now, of course, but they were formative years, weren't they?
Yes. Well, I was there the last year of Glenn Byam Shaw's term as artistic director, and it was when Peter Hall was around and he was going to take over the next year. So in one way it bridged that gap between what was the old system at Stratford of having stars in annually for the season, and then the start of Peter's new and revolutionary regime of growing his own stars. Mm. And I walked on for people like Olivier, Dame Edith Evans, Robeson played Othello, oh. Charles Laughton played King Lear, and it was absolutely extraordinary. Mm. And then the following year, it was youngsters playing.
Yeah.
Peter O'Toole playing Shylock, Dorothy Tutin playing Viola. It was absolutely fascinating.
It was 60-61 you were voted the most promising newcomer.
I don't remember that.
Oh, well, I looked it up. You wouldn't remember that.
No.
And then you got a special mention or special award for your Cordelia, didn't you?
Do you see, I simply don't remember these things.
But Cordelia must stand in your mind because it was one of your big ones earlier.
Yes. It was extraordinary. Watching Paul Scofield as Lear was quite amazing. And every generation has a performance, or if they're lucky, two or three performances, which people will always, always remember throughout their lives. And I think the people who saw Scofield as Lear will always remember him. Alec McCann was the fool. Mm. He was amazing. I was finding my way. I think I was very lucky to be playing Cordelia. I certainly wasn't on top of my art, but I was lucky enough, and here's one of the really good things, as indeed there are many, about being in a company, that sometimes you can be promoted beyond your capabilities and you grow into them by finding yourself in that position. And I look back on Cordelia as being that point in my life.
What did you tour with when you went to... Did you go to Russia, Eastern Europe and America? Yes.
We toured in Lear and Comedy of Errors. And we went to Russia and Czechoslovakia and Romania and Finland. It was absolutely extraordinary. What was so amazing about it was that the tragedy went down a treat. The comedy, because it was rambunctious and it was done in a commedia dell'arte fashion, they'd never seen this degree of irreverence on the stage before. And it was greeted with total silence, largely.
Really?
Yes. Rather upsetting.
Really? Yes, imagine. Now, with all this wealth of experience behind you at the RSC, what was your reaction, and here it comes, when Emma Peel came along?
Well, by that time I'd been at the Royal Shakespeare Company for 5 years, and they'd asked me to sign another 3-year contract, and indeed had offered me some wonderful parts to go with it. I sensed that there was a world elsewhere. I had absolutely no idea what that world would contain, but I needed to develop in other directions. I just felt I had to. I had no money, because one was paid very little at the RSC, so I had nothing to live on if I was going to be out of work. Nonetheless, at that age, you know you can do just about anything. You can waitress, you can bluff your way through. And that's one of the things that actors have, is a sense of their own potential to get by, thank goodness. So I left, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I did one rather terrible television, two, in fact, which paid the rent. And then suddenly...
Do you remember what they were?
Yes, one was called Sentimental Agent. It was a series starring Carlos X, who was Lily Palmer's husband. And I remember it was supposed to take place in Palm Springs, and instead of which we filmed it in Chertsey, with a lot of shivering palms. Mm. And the other one was called The Hot House with Harry Corbett.
I see. Yes.
And I wasn't very good in either, needless to say. Then I got a call from my agent to say that they were looking for somebody to take over from Honor Blackman as... I forget what was Honor called. I can't remember. Can anybody remember what she called?
Kathy Gale.
Yeah,
you are, you see.
And I didn't have a television, so I had absolutely no idea what this involved. But I was asked to pitch up at this studio at 10:30 in the morning, dressed in black, which wasn't a favorite color at that point. So I had to borrow a jersey and borrow sweaters, and I had a black pair of black boots, and I pitched up there. And they put me in a dressing room, an airless dressing room, for an hour and a half, after which I thought, this is ridiculous. So I got in a taxi and went to see a friend of mine, had a cup of coffee, and went back, and they still hadn't missed me. And then I was called onto the stage finally about 4:30 in the afternoon, where I was given a page of dialogue, which I had to play with Pat McNee, and then I was asked to go into a fight with this stuntman. Well, this poor stuntman had been in 18 fights that day, and he'd been hit over the head with a handbag by 18 aspiring actresses, all of which desperately wanted the part, so they'd hit him very hard. And he was seeing stars. Anyway, I did this fight. I thought it was all a bit of a lark.
I couldn't
take it at all seriously. Went home, and my agent telephoned the next day and said that I'd got the job, and indeed 2 days later, I was filming it.
Extraordinary.
And I had no idea what it involved. It was a job, it sounded fun. It didn't pay very much money. I liked Pat a lot. The script was quite larky. And having done a lot of very serious stuff, it sort of tickled my fancy to do this.
I'm sure, yes.
So I was, again, utterly flabbergasted by the effect that television had on my career. I had absolutely no idea it would do this for me.
How much of the character did you create?
Well, not very much to begin with, as you can imagine. I mean, anybody cares to see the first few episodes. Well, they don't know which the first episodes are, because they always mix them about.
Yeah.
But I could certainly tell. I was feeling my way. Then, obviously, the more confident one became, and the more one's relationship with Patrick grew, a style emerged.
Mm.
And we were able to, and we were allowed to rewrite the script.
Were you?
Yes. Not the storyline,
but
how we approached things. Mm. And I think largely they were very wise, the producers, to allow us to do this, because this contributed very much to what came over.
It meant that you became internationally known, of course,
yes.
And this is a great thing.
Yes.
Did it actually in the end become something of a monster to you? Was it something you couldn't shake off?
I think when I first left, it was quite hard, because I was always offered parts with ladies with gun in hand and slightly militant. And indeed, the interesting thing about Emma Peel was she came on the wave of Women's Lib.
Yes, of course.
So she, certainly in America, she became a figurehead of Women's Lib, which was all very well, but it didn't entirely line up with my personal philosophy. And so I was always finding myself dragged into certain issues that I'd rather have dodged.
Yeah.
So there was that aspect to it as well. And then the constraints upon one's art. The fact that producers saw one as this person. I knew I could do much more than that. So I had to fight my way out of that a little bit.
But you did do other things. I mean, there was Abelard and Heloise.
Yes, well, in the middle of doing The Avengers, I went back and did Viola at Stratford. In fact, I commuted between Stratford and the film studio.
Your idea?
Yes.
Good idea.
That was still trying to fly the serious actress banner.
Sure.
Not that anybody took much notice.
I bet they pulled them in, didn't it, at Stratford?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I mean,
it
suddenly.
Was great fun. No, no, they were pulling them in a great... They were hugely successful then.
Yes, they must have contributed.
Yes, but I don't know. It's always been a popular play, Twelfth Night.
Yes,
always.
That's right, yes. But then
Abelard
and Heloise. Then, of course, Jumpers, Tom Stoppard's Jumpers, which was enormously successful.
Yes.
You looked as though you romped through Jumpers. You looked as though you loved every moment.
Well,
did
yes,
you?
One did. It was wonderful. It was quite an extraordinary experience, the beginning, the rehearsals, because nobody quite knew what the effect of this play would be on the audience. Tom Stoppard being the genius that he is, the play is very dense, and he drops little threads throughout the acts, and then these threads are delicately and effortlessly and deliciously picked up through the ensuing acts, and the audience has to be on the ball in order to catch on. Now, our first preview, the revolve went wrong, various other technical things went wrong, and it took 4.5 hours.
Oh.
And nonetheless, the audience were entirely captured.
Mm.
And it was most exciting evening. And from then on, of course, it went from strength to strength. I shall never forget the look on Michael Horden's face. He had the most extraordinary speeches to make. And he'd anguished over these speeches and worked extraordinarily hard, and suddenly they paid off, and he was like a man released.
All of which should give our audience a little ammunition. They're going to be asking you questions in a couple of minutes' time. First, we take a break.
All the best things in shopping are under one roof. There's no traffic, no hustle, and that is the truth.
Most shops open tomorrow, 10 till 8.
When you're shopping with ease, stay as long as you please. Brent Cross is the Northwest End. There is so much to see, we think you'll agree. It's the best place to spend. Brent Cross is the Northwest End. Brent Cross.
Migraine. Migraine headache. Nausea. Vomiting. Migraine can be more than just one problem. So try Migralift, an effective treatment to help with the symptoms of migraine. Not just a painkiller, Migralift is a balanced treatment to help relieve nausea, vomiting, and migraine headache. The proven Migralift formula has been used by thousands of sufferers. For the symptoms of migraine, headache, nausea, or vomiting, take Migralift from your pharmacist.
LBC Radio News. The government is launching a major review of motorway safety in a bid to cut down accidents and hold-ups. The move follows a series of disastrous pile-ups and a big increase in the number of cars using the aging network. Coast Guards and the RAF are praising the courage of the crew of a German trawler who rescued 14 seamen from a freighter in danger of sinking in mountainous seas. The tug is now on its way from Penzance to try to salvage the ship, which is drifting in the Atlantic off Ireland. At least 24 civilians and a policeman have been killed during renewed violence in Sri Lanka. Police opened fire on demonstrators in the capital, Colombo, apparently in reprisal for an ambush by Tamil guerrillas in the east of the country. Police are searching the countryside around Aberystwyth in Mid Wales for an elderly woman who's been missing from her home since Christmas Eve. They fear the frail pensioner could fall victim to exposure because she left home without weatherproof clothing. The weather staying dull, drizzly and very mild in London, though there'll be a fairly blustery southwesterly wind blowing. Today's top temperature, 12 or 13 Celsius, 54 to 55 Fahrenheit. Tonight, no change, still overcast and mild with rain or drizzle at times. Temperatures falling no lower than 10 Celsius, 50 Fahrenheit. LBC Radio.
At Courts Furnishing Stores and Courts Mammoth Superstores' biggest ever winter sale, there are huge reductions in all departments. Superb upholstery savings. Three-piece suites from under £200 to over £1,000. Big bargains in beds and bedrooms, with divan beds from under £40 to over £400. Dining sets and wall units from under £100 to over £700. And a dazzling range of carpets, all at sale prices. Save in style at Courts Winter Sale. At all Courts stores and Courts Mammoth Superstores at Luton, Milton Keynes, Oxford, Southend, Stevenage, West Thurrock and Staples Corner, London. On now and open holiday Monday.
Welcome back to this Christmas edition of the Celebrity Interview at the Barbican, and questions from the audience are the order of the day. Diana Rigg is waiting, as always, with some trepidation when the person sits up here for the first question. Who's it to be, please? Oh, yes, sir, right down the front here.
Do you find, making a TV series, The Avengers, much harder, more demanding than a TV play or stage play?
Yes, most definitely. For the reasons that you pitch up to work at 6:30 in order to be on the floor, made up and ready to go at 8:30. And if you're on location, you can film until the light goes, which in the summertime can be 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, which is extraordinarily physically demanding. On top of that, you don't have any time to learn your lines other than when you go home at night, and you have a fresh set of lines to learn every day, because you have no time to learn in advance. And your wits have to be about you at every minute of the day. And it's the intrusion in one's private life also, which is very hard to deal with.
Does it mean you don't like doing that sort of thing, or you'd prefer not to?
I don't think I would do another series.
Really?
I rather feel that I've done that. I've paid my dues, and I'm very grateful for the results, but I'm not prepared to live an entirely professional life. I was unmarried at the time. I enjoyed every minute of it, but I'm not prepared to live an entirely professional life anymore.
Well, that's definite enough, isn't it? I'm glad I asked.
Having been, as you said, a latecomer to doing musicals and song and dance routines, how did you feel when first approached about doing Follies?
I was extremely nervous. There are two, well, many elements in being nervous about a new venture. Failure, of course, is predominant. Secondly, the material that we deal with in Follies is so wonderful that you do want to do it justice. Thirdly, whether you indeed were physically up to it, because it's extraordinarily demanding. A musical requires a quite different kind of energy. Singing, you're using your rib cage, and you have to have huge reserves of breath. And the energy that you show on stage, you have to show your energy in a musical, whereas in a play, it veins your performance. But you have to actually be bursting with energy when you step on stage for a musical. So I had to consider all those things, whether I could dance, whether I could sing. Needless to say, I'm still considering them 6 months into the run. But I do enjoy doing it very much indeed. And surrounded as I am by, and this is another of the great pleasures, wonderful musical stars. Julia McKenzie, Dolores Gray, Pearl Carr, Teddy Johnson, Dan Massey. I mean, I go through the cast. They are wonderful, and watching them nightly is a joy. And I don't regret it for an instant.
You have sung before, haven't you?
I did. I did a musical in America, in fact, which closed in Denver, for which I'm deeply grateful. So that again, you know, that was attendant upon my fears. I failed once. Would I fail again? I sang in jumpers,
yes,
if you remember, not very well. So I prepared myself for this. I went to dance classes months ahead of time, and I took singing lessons months ahead of time. I think in the end I was my own worst enemy when it came to those early previews and the first night, because I couldn't believe that I could do it. Now I'm doing it nightly, and I can believe I can do it, and I'm enjoying doing it.
Mm. Just before we leave America, there was another thing that was a bit disastrous over there, wasn't it? A series they were going to do based on your life, Diana.
Oh, no, it wasn't my life, no. It was a series which I subsequently discovered was a pale edition of the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Oh, I see.
And they flew me over there at huge expense and put me into this series, which, again, I did for 18 hours a day and failed miserably.
Yeah.
But as with all failures, and I'm very happy to discuss failures because I find them fascinating. They're also very funny.
Mm.
I paid off my mortgage. Ah. There was the golden lining to that particular failure. But the joke about that was, I must tell you, it just rather sums up America. We did it in front of a live audience every week, and it was extraordinarily tough. It was absolutely amazing. When I arrived, they sent a smoked glass limousine several blocks long to take me to my rented house in the Hollywood Hills. And I thought, goodness, this is wonderful. This is the way life in Hollywood, I've always believed it was led, and here I am leading it. And then when the show was cancelled and I was sent home, they sent the studio station wagon.
Yes. This actually has been said in another way on this very stage. I can't remember who it was. It was one of the actors who said that when you're a success, on Broadway particularly, they fake you. They bring out the limousines. But when you're a failure, you find your own way to the airport.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
As rigid as that. Right, let's have another
question. Okay. At this rate, I assure you, Bertram, I do enjoy female nudity on the stage. Bertram, at the same time as I enjoy it, two questions do rather worry me. First of all, is it legitimate for me to enjoy it? And secondly, does an actress have to be persuaded by a director, or does she feel that it's actually essential to the scene? And I must say, I did enjoy that famous scene in Jumpers, which you mentioned.
Right, well, that's a question and a half.
Well, here's sex raising its ugly head again, isn't it? I'll take the second half of the question. I did it in Abelard and Eloise. And I regret that I did it. At the time, one was persuaded to do it. It is not one's natural inclination to take one's clothes off. I can assure you It is one of the most uncomfortable things in the world, and nightly I found it an embarrassment and a hurdle. And I think most actresses would feel the same, unless, of course, they are strippers by profession. I regret doing it because it was proven subsequently the actress who played the part refused to do it, and it continued to run in the West End highly successfully.
That's all you're saying?
That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's fine. Thank you very much indeed.
Frigg, you dabbled in writing in No Stone Unturned. Do you have any further hopes to write or ambitions?
Yes, I do.
Let's get the title right first. It's No Turn Unstone. That's all right. No. Hence, a very, very clever title.
I love it. I have doubts about whether I'm terribly good, because I anguish over it so much, and it's like getting blood out of a stone. But yes, and I'm just about, in fact, when I finish Follies, I'm beginning to research another one. It's the research which I love best of all, because you go beavering into libraries and into all sorts of unexpected places. You find texts which apply to your subject. And it's like finding truffles. It's a treasure hunt, you know?
Yeah.
That part of it I love. It's the 10,000-word introduction, which I weep over. Mm. But the end result, I was so pleased with the end result of No Turn Unstone. This is not self-congratulation, because I had somebody who helped me with it. That it went into two paperbacks, and it's sold in America. The only part of it which I regret is that many people misconstrued, in fact, the reason behind the book. I wrote it, or I compiled it, as a celebration of survival, actors and actresses, that despite the process of criticism, we survive. And when it came out, many people interpreted the book as a knock against critics, which it certainly wasn't.
Given the book as it stands, and it's a tremendous book, I've been reading it again just recently,
yes.
And the reason for the title you've just explained, just for people who've never heard of it,
yes.
In case there's anybody listening, unlikely, but there you are,
yes.
That sort of review, if you get that sort of review yourself, does it badly affect you?
Oh, yes.
Does it?
Yes. Oh, it's dreadful. I defy anybody not to be hurt by what they see written in print about themselves. I don't read notices anymore. Because you have to perform that night, and you are, no matter how strong you are influenced by what you've read about yourself. And you're equally influenced if they say brilliant and marvelous and wonderful. You could probably go on and give a rather sort of careless performance. You might. So I don't read them when they come out. I may happen upon them months later, or in an old magazine at the hairdresser's or something like that, by which time the barbs aren't quite as sharp.
It's a difficult situation, isn't it? Because people who have taken action against crits that have been particularly vindictive only succeed in drawing attention to that very crit and making it far more obvious to people who might never have known it existed.
Yes, I think the best thing to do is to go quietly.
Yeah.
But we are now talking about irresponsible criticism. We're not talking about the body of criticism,
yeah.
Which largely is extremely good. And indeed, I read the critics on the plays which are opening in London with great interest and take notice of them.
Have you any unfulfilled ambitions?
Unfulfilled ambitions?
I don't. It sounds very dull.
Right, next question.
My ambition becomes centred when I'm offered something which I desperately want to do, and I want to do it as well as I can. Once upon a time, I had an ambition to do Lady Macbeth, and I did Lady Macbeth. And I will not do Lady Macbeth again. It was not entirely successful, and as a part, I found it not entirely satisfactory. She aborts halfway through the second act and runs downhill. She comes on firing all guns in the first half, and It's a very badly constructed part. Of course, people have been brilliant in it, but not me.
Miss Riggs, do you think you are going to concentrate on television series, or are going for Shakespeare, or maybe something in a classical vein like that?
My career is like a patchwork quilt. I've done contrasting things, one upon the other, it seems to me. I've gone from a television series to the classics, to something commercial, to something else serious. I tend to switch around, and it's very much dependent upon one's appetite. Now, having done a musical, I would probably feel like doing something serious. I mean, I would love to do a classic play, I think, probably, following on Follies. It's like a meal. One's career is like a meal. You have your roast beef, two veg, and then you want to follow it by something sweet. Do you see what I mean?
So you'll do just what you feel like.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It followed through your life, really. I mean, without dwelling too much on it, you had your ups and downs in life. I remember reading the time you were doing Phaedra in town. You were a very unhappy person, a very lonely person. Then you had a short-lived marriage.
Yes.
Then you took yourself off to Mexico for some reason or other, didn't you?
Well,
lost a lot of weight.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, that's the private side of my life. I mean, Phaedra, it was a wonderful part. And again, I'd like to try it again, because I don't think I entirely succeeded in it. But it sort of mirrored my life at that time. And professionally, it doesn't always happen that way. You know, you can be playing a tragedy and be divinely happy, or vice versa. And the main thing is that one doesn't, in fact, allow one's professional life to colour one's private life.
If one can possibly help it.
If one can help it.
That's the negative side. The positive side, of course, was that along came Archie, and along came Rachel.
Yes.
Did motherhood change you?
Oh, radically. I had concentrated entirely upon my career, and with the advent of a child, I had to reconsider my life profoundly from the bottom up. And I have subsequently made certain rules which I will not break. I work in bursts, Follies being a burst. I then will spend 6 to 9 months not working and spending my life entirely with my family. When I am working, I do not, I don't leave the house except to take the dog and the children to the park on a Sunday. Sundays are absolutely sacred. They are the one day when I can spend from rising in the morning to putting my daughter to bed, or indeed going to bed with her, which I do on occasions when I'm really tired. We both of us sit up in bed and watch the 9 o'clock news and then switch off and go to sleep. This is when my husband's away, obviously. Those Sundays are sacred, and I will not deviate. Other rules, I will, wherever possible, be at home or meet her from school. In other words, I try to keep a normal home life as much as possible when I'm working. Of course, it's incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And it's give and take on both sides. I mean, my daughter is very understanding and very good about it, and so is my husband. When I leave the house at 6:15 or 6 o'clock every night, it's just when most people come home to spend time with their children. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it is a precious time, because that's the time when you play games, tell stories, and tuck them up in bed. Now, I won't have been doing that for a year, and I have to make reparation.
Yeah. What happened to the strident independence you used to exude? Did that get softened a bit by motherhood?
Oh, softened nothing. It's gone.
You were a very independent person, weren't you?
Necessarily so. I don't think people quite understand. Looking back, I don't entirely like my stridency of those days, but it was a measure of self-preservation.
Yes.
It's not an easy life. Obviously, aspects of it are very easy. You're first-class air tickets, wonderful hotels, meeting terrific people, glamorous. But there is a lot of loneliness involved, and there's a lot of exploitation involved of yourself, and you have to learn to preserve yourself against that. I didn't. I allowed myself in those early Avenger days to be horribly exploited. My ma has a trunk full of cuttings, which I daren't. It's like Pandora's box. I daren't open it, because I know that the person I'm going to find in there, I'm going to really thoroughly dislike.
Really?
Yes.
Have you had any really embarrassing moments?
That's the other one, isn't it?
Yes, it's the other one. Well, always to do with things going wrong on the stage. Or, I mean, recently, I in Follies, I do a strip number. Well, I don't take my clothes off. I appear to. It's the traditional strip. And I've got all sorts of corsets on and stockings on underneath.
Oh.
But it's a pastiche strip. And
you do appear to take both.
I do appear to, but I don't. So there. But recently, because of the amount of dancing I've been doing at the rape stage at the theatre, I have developed housemaid's knee, which is very unfortunate. I also developed something, I think it was a boil in my armpit. So I went on doing a strip with plaster on my knee and plaster in my armpit. Now, I consider that pretty embarrassing.
Pretty embarrassing. We wouldn't have known about it had you not told
us. Well, I'm telling you.
Thank you very much indeed. Have we any other questions? One down here.
Miss Frigg, from what I can gather, your career has been centred between television and stage. Have you considered the films, and what are your views about making a film in the cinema?
I'd love to make more films. I don't get offered very good films very often.
You've never really broken in?
I've never really broken in. I think partly the choice of films that I did early on meant that I wasn't considered as a serious film actress. The best part I was ever offered was in a film little known with George C. Scott called The Hospital, written by a wonderful American writer called Paddy Chayefsky. And indeed, it was Paddy Chayefsky who insisted that I play the part. Otherwise, I don't think I would have played it. I'd like to do better films. I have one unfortunate hurdle, which is when you film, as I did, an episode every 10 days, you learn to shorthand your film acting, because that's the most effective at that time. Indeed, that's the sort of acting you see in Dynasty and Dallas and on. And I can do it off the top of my head. And it's very facile and very easy. And I think I tend to slip into that when I do a film, and I need a very strong director to get hold of me and pull something better out of me.
Hmm.
And it hasn't happened.
Well, let's hope it will.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Well, 2 points. Firstly, I have to say that I totally disagree with you about your performance as Lady Macbeth. I think I owe my English literature O-level to your performance.
That's good. That's terrific.
That's another point. As far as the Avengers is concerned, there's still a lot of it about. There's memorabilia, there are various conventions, certainly in the United States, and quite a lot in this country. Do you ever reach a stage when you're bored by the Avengers?
No, I don't. I now look on it with a sort of wry fondness, because I'm old enough and the years have gone by and I'm no longer a victim of the great Avengers hype. It's very sweet at the stage door. These photographs are pushed under my nose of myself all those years ago, and I have to sign them, and I'm rather apologetic because it's not the same person at all. Sometimes they're sepia coloured.
Right, let's just turn to one or two other things. You did cooperate with Archie, your husband, in a play called Wildfire. It didn't have an enormous success.
It didn't have any success.
No. Would that failure, if I can call it that by the look on your face, would that put you against doing a similar type of thing again in the West End?
What, in working for my husband?
Yes, and pulling a play out of, it was an unknown play, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. No, it was an unfortunate venture. It was unfortunate in
many respects won, but it failed and lost a great deal of money. Archie has, in fact, produced more than that in the West End, and very successfully. What happens when that occurs is that you go away and lick your wounds. And so, I mean, it doesn't preclude us ever doing it again. Mm. But it's just a question of finding the right thing. And indeed, it's every actor's cry. Oh, for a wonderful new play.
Yes, I remember the press saying at the time, things like she was staking her professional reputation. Did it hurt you?
Oh, yes. It's terrible to fail. I mean, it's particularly bad to fail when you're working for your husband. Boot has put the money up for it, and he's obviously going to lose. It's also, and it was most interesting, this, because it had never happened to me before, playing to a half-empty theatre is one of the most depressing experiences in the world. And the other actors in the play were very sweet and funny about it. And they said, welcome to the real theatre, because I'd never done it before. And it requires a very strong discipline. You have to go on and give of your best undeviatingly, no matter what number of people are out there, until the play closes. By that time, you know, pack up your bags, heave a huge sigh of relief, and go home. I wouldn't not have gone through it. I'd rather Archie hadn't produced it. Mm. But you learn from failure. Again, I learnt that the play was flawed from the beginning, and that no matter how much work one did on it, and one was working with Peter Wood, brilliant director, we couldn't solve it.
It always seems odd, you see, to people who've not been involved in that side of the business, not to understand how a person as experienced as you, and indeed Archie himself, couldn't see that flaw right at the outset.
Yes, we saw the flaw at the outset, but we honestly thought it could be fixed.
Really?
Now, a lot of plays in the West End that you see on the stage have been fixed on the road. By fix, I mean they have been rewritten, amended, recast, redirected, whatever. Indeed, in America, they have what's known as play doctors. They will bring in somebody else who has not written the play to fix it. Mm. And we thought we could. The germ was right, and we thought we could fix it, but we couldn't.
Finally, regretfully, finally, is there life after Follies?
No, there's a domestic life after Follies, and then a professional life after that.
Anything planned long term?
No. I have the book, which I look forward to, which means I can do it while my daughter is at school and be at home when she comes back.
Is it going to be similar to the last?
It'll be a compilation, an anthology, hopefully readable and fun. What I love are commonplace books. I love dipping books, other people do them brilliantly.
Bedside books,
yes, and it'll be something a bit like that.
Diana Rigg, we wish you success with whatever you've got coming up, and thank you very much indeed for joining us. Diana Rigg.
M35, you'll find heavy traffic in both directions between junctions 10 and 14, that's the A3 and Heathrow turnoffs. It's the sheer motor traffic and an earlier clockwise accident. Dartford Tunnel, still very busy southbound. It's a 6-mile queue at the moment. Northbound, there was a 2-mile queue earlier. It's virtually back to normal now, under a 0.5-mile queue. But southbound at the tunnel, it's a 6-mile queue at the moment. Hyde Park, the march has started. The route it's taking is Cumberland Gate, then the A40 Bayswater Road and Notting Hill Gate, and then Pembridge Road and Kensington Park Road. Do expect one or two delays. And in Romford, traffic lights are out of order on the A12 Eastern Avenue at the junction with North Street. Grenville, A Road Watch.
A Dickens and Jones winter sale. We're taking rather a lot off. Tomorrow and Tuesday, we'll be taking an extra 10% off sale prices for holders of Fraser cards only. The Dickens and Jones sale preview, taking off even more this winter.
The turkey's all eaten, the carol's all sung, The dining table's at it, the spare bed's unsprung.
Whatever Christmas was really like, it's good to know the Perrings Home Furnishing Sale starts tomorrow. Lots to see and save on, especially three-piece upholstered suites, many for immediate delivery. The Perrings Sale starts tomorrow.